I'm always very intrigued by how, for example, when you're looking at that healing dynamic, how do you put flesh on Romans 5:5, you know, such that it does operate, as you say it does, on values and then impacting on knowledge, and then on the subsequent two levels. That's really continues to be a question. I'm just saying, I hear it, I understand it, but how does actually, you know, when the rubber hits the road, how does it actually do that? You know, how does, for example, a religious experience and Romans 5:5 impact such that you begin to see values along the preferential scale, you know, and such that those values and their integral structure then begins to impact upon decisions and business?
It would have something to do with the way it opens you to self-transcendence, I think, because I think the whole scale of values is based on self-transcendence. I think the levels of value are isomorphic with the level of consciousness, so you're talking of self-transcendence. Yeah. Now, others have disagreed with me on that, but they haven't found any evidence in Lauderdale that that's the basis of the scale of values. I'm convinced that it's right, that that's right. And I did find in the lectures that Greg is transcribing or putting together right now in the Boston 68, he makes the explicit link between that the scale of values is based on some transcendence. So it is isomorphic with the levels of consciousness.
I mean, in it's chapter 4 of Theology and Dialectics, I mean, that you put a lot of time into that whole isomorphic relationship.
Pat Byrne has questioned that. Just, I think it's more that he says, well, I'm not so sure. You know, I don't know what the origin of it. He's not denying the scale of values, but he doesn't know what the origin of it is. To me, it was always almost obvious that the self-transcendence was the criterion for the scale. But anyway. But I think it has something to do with that, because that love opens you to, you know, as long as you continue to stay open with the openness that love frees you for, then you're going to see value, and you're going to have some sense of the interrelation of values and what's more important and what's less important, and how, you know, I mean, but also social science has got to come in here too.
Sure.
You know, it can't be not just a religious thing, you know. Which is the phenomenological, cultural, symbolic approach to social science has a very distinct thing to offer. This is one example. Because what it insists on is how dependent social structures are on the web of meanings in the culture, you know. Which would be denied by a Marxist, pure Marxism, not revisionist Marxism.
No, I understand. Yeah.
By a pure Marxist, they would just throw that out the window, you know. And we had a provincial who, at least when he was a scholastic, had no use for cultural superstructure, you know, which is frightening in a Jesuit provincial because
that's exactly what
you're. Yeah. I mean, what we've been doing for 400 years has been basically cultural superstructure with education, with art, with theater, with, you know. We've been doing cultural, so he's denying all history and all society. Anyway,
thank you for allowing me to be here.
Oh, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah. Really, really, very interesting.
Yeah, he did a nice job.
Excellent job. In the course that I was leading with Eileen Deneb at the Thomas More Institute last fall, that was precisely one of the essays.
Religious experience? Yeah.
Well, not religious, but this one here, Healing, Creating History.
Really, that's a big one for them up
there.
That's
major,
It marked their history. I mean, it's one of the major things he did there. It just got out. It's that little publication by Eric O'Connor, you know. I think they had to keep producing that because people wanted to read that.
I know.
That was the key one in there. All right, I got to go get a little water and stretch my leg for a minute.
Thank you, Dennis.
Yep, you bet. I'd like to do is to, you would prefer, Jeff, that we raise questions first, and then we want to give you some time to get through the second one. What would you need for that?
Probably require half an hour to get through the second one.
Okay, so we'll take maybe roughly at the most 10 minutes of questions or discussion, if there are such things. Robbie, you have something? You always have something.
No, I have. I like the way he treats symbols in these lectures, I think. I'm not sure if I... in my reading, I can't remember him treating it in such a... maybe an emphatic way, or... he really, I like that place where he kind of, at the end, he says, we become normal human beings when we vast... when we... how does he say? When we master vast systems of symbols. In a way, it's not just religious experience, but you know, there's a symbolic ground that we need to appropriate.
Okay, I have another question. It's something that I'm living. It's an academic experience that I have now. I'm in a class or one.
Sorry, but I can't
hear. I won't say the name of the class, but I have a class of that's kind of philosophical foundations, and it's not philosophy. I don't know what it is, but it's sure it's not theology, and and it's in Trinity, and I have these problems with general categories and special categories. Because the person is talking about religion and violence, and the person supposes that not having a commitment with religion will allow you to expand your capacity to understand things, to comprehend more the experience, the religious experience, and to see it. Without a judgment of value and having some detachment that will allow you to see more things. So how, you know, maybe that's religious studies, how to link all this, to make an approximation to religion. I think Lonergan is already suggesting in this chapter, in this lecture, that commitment is important. It allows you to see more things about religion than without a commitment. How to have a discussion with someone from religious studies who doesn't have a commitment, and how to see the possibility of engaging a discourse without a religious commitment, or understanding without religious commitment. And is it really better not to have a commitment to understand more religion than to have it? That's I think Lonergan's position, right? Well, for me, it does help. For me, it's impossible not to have a commitment with religion. I mean, it's an existential thing. But to understand that somehow they're saying, put into parentheses your commitments. You can have it in your internal form, but here, the important things to understand. So how do I link all this? Understanding, religious studies, theology, general categories, special categories, capacity of detachment to understand more and to penetrate more the religious experience.
That's a whole course. Can I make a few comments on this? I think that the professor that you're talking about, first of all, is taking a stance that is beyond that of research, interpretation, and history. It's a stance, it's a dialectical position that is being presented to you there. There's plenty of evidence for the correctness, by the way, of that position. Because there's plenty of evidence of how religious commitment stops people from questioning and closes their minds. So there's a lot of evidence for that. This is part of the point, as I understand it, of a recent book, which I have not read, by Sam Harris, called The End of Faith, where he's writing not only against religious extremism in Islam and Christian fundamentalism and so on, but also saying that those of us who are moderate and don't use religion for violent purposes are just being foolish, because we could live just as good a life without religion. And we're wasting a lot of our time trying to be religious. And he's not questioning that we're not halfway decent people, at least we're not fanatics and violent people, but why do you need this, you know? In other words, for him, religion is intrinsically tied up. Religious commitment is intrinsically tied up with extremism. And, now, I want to say that Lonergan's one of the few theologians who has explicitly gone out of his way to argue that there is no conflict between religious commitment and open-ended questioning. And in fact, that open-ended questioning is authentic, and that any obscurantism that would shut off questions is inauthentic. And if it comes from religion, then that's inauthentic religion. If religion tries to get you to close your mind, it's inauthentic. Okay. Now, he's one of the few, and as he said when the time that he wrote Insight, where he's making points like this, as he said, if I had written it in Latin, they probably would have read it and I would have gotten into trouble. Because of precisely things like the same. But now, today, I mean, I don't think that any religious leader would tell you to stop questioning. I mean, they might wish that you would, but they won't. They can't get away with it anymore. So that would be one thing that, I mean, inauthentic religious commitment, yes, but no. For Lonergan, religious, moral, and intellectual conversion are a unit, you know, and so religious conversion is not going to be opposed to intellectual conversion, and intellectual conversion is a commitment to questioning as the way to reach understanding and truth. So that would be part of what I would respond to that position. But again, I would grant an awful lot of it. I had a Jewish fellow come to see me the other day who had read this book that I'm talking about, Harris's book, and he wanted to talk about it. And I said, what you do with it is essentially what Ricoeur did with Freud, and I used the example there. You take the critique of religion seriously, which is what Ricoeur did with Freud. He took it very seriously. And he said, and he used it to purify Christianity, his own commitment. And we can do the same thing. If in fact, Harris's book is a responsible book, and I don't know whether it is or not, but there is an awful lot of religious inauthenticity. There has been tremendous use within Christianity, as well as in other religions, of religion for inauthentic and violent purposes. The Crusades and the Inquisition and all of that is just part of that. Now, the past recent pope was the first one in history to apologize for all of that stuff, and he was sincere in that apology. And I hope we keep apologizing for those kinds of mistakes, because they are mistakes. It's an inauthentic application. It's inauthentic religion. It's not what Lonergan's taught. It's not being in love. So that's if being in love, if religion is being in love, which is what it is for Lonergan, then there's no conflict between love and understanding. So that would be part of my... And I know the professor that you're talking about, and I get along very well with the professor. We're very good friends. And I'd like to speak at some point about all of this, and I probably could, you know. I'm not going to give any more hints.
I'm wondering about this Sam Harris speaking up. Wouldn't Lonergan say that when he... that religious experience in itself moves one towards commitment, independent of the various religious traditions.
Yes.
There is a commitment in openness to religious experience.
That's right.
So commitment is not just being kind of kind of blindly enclosed by a tradition.
No.
It's not.
No, and in fact, the commitment that it opens you to is a commitment that could involve really questioning the authenticity of your tradition. That's why he speaks of major unauthenticity, is the unauthenticity of the tradition. And he's got this wrenching statement in the next essay about that we all have to face the question of whether what we're doing is promoting an unauthentic tradition. You know, we may be authentically promoting unauthenticity. That's pretty devastating. Anyway, I don't want to steal your fire, because that's part of what he's doing in the next. I think we should give Jeff a chance to move on, okay? You have the rest of it is yours.
Thanks. Okay, well, moving to the second lecture, again, to remind you, his concern was religious studies and theology. This is part of the same series of lectures at Queen's University, so he still got that focal interest. So when you read the title of this lecture, Religious Knowledge, there are all kinds of interesting questions you might want to get from the text, but he's still pursuing this question of the relationship between religious studies and theology. But he established, recall in the last lecture, dialectic. So now he is at least able to move into a consideration of religious knowledge. We got past infrastructure, we considered superstructure, now we're moving into the consideration of an actual affirmation that can be made when you apply superstructure to data, to religious experience. In the beginning of the lecture, Lonergan pushes aside the question of whether religious persons have some kind of special knowledge or whether that can be anything more than just private. He wants to talk about a philosophical possibility. Notice how careful Lonergan's language is here. He wants to talk about a philosophical possibility, namely, what could be meant, notice the conditional sort of nature of that, those words, what could be meant by affirming the validity or objectivity of religious knowledge. So he's not even affirming the validity or objectivity of it. He's seeing what the sort of effect might be of affirming it in any particular instance. And he says he's also concerned with how one can tell whether one's appropriation of religion is genuine or unauthentic, or more frighteningly, whether the religion itself is genuine or unauthentic. Now, I mentioned in the last lecture we get to self-transcendence. Here it is mentioned specifically. He's got a section entitled Self-Transcendence. Earlier he gave the example of love of spouse, love of nation, love of God. Now he's going to pursue this a bit more. He explains that when we wake up in the morning, we're pulled beyond ourselves, slightly biologically, but also with memories and anticipations, getting ready for the day, and so on. That's a preliminary instance of being pulled beyond ourselves, self-transcendence, but there's more of it, namely, when we enter the world mediated by meaning. So there, we're subjects in the world and we're exercising intelligence and abstraction, imagination, and so on. So now we're even further beyond ourselves, but not in the sense of self-escape. This is one of the things that people can sometimes confuse self-transcendence for, is somehow climbing above oneself. Well, it's not. Going beyond, really, as we're going to see, is nothing more than authentic subjectivity. So by self-transcendence, he really just means radical you-ness, being you really in your whatness, not escaping yourself. So you wake up, you go out into the world, but then he says there are even further steps. You've used your intelligence and imagination and so on, but then you submit the constructions of intelligence and imagination to the control of reasonableness, and in doing so, you may or may not come into contact with reality. Well, you can see what he's doing here is he's setting up levels of self-transcendence in correspondence with the structure of consciousness. So you might think of the waking up part. If people are reading this and they're not really familiar with the structure, they might say, "Why is he saying? Why is he saying we wake up and then you go out?" He's sort of trying to line it up with the structure. So waking up is kind of being attentive. You know, you wake up, you look around, and you go out into the world, you try and understand this vast system of relations. Then you even try to be reasonable, reach reality. And then he says, but you know what? There's even more going beyond yourself than that. And the further step is to go beyond asking what is to asking what ought to be. And this is the deliberative level of consciousness. So, and interestingly, he says that when you reach that beyondness, there is effected a transition from consciousness to conscience. So we really become moral agents, not simply by asking what is. You can be a great scientist and sort of get to being, but it's something more to say what ought to be. And here on this level of deliberation, the fourth level, self-transcendence really emerges. The decision to be who you want to be, and even, he says, what you might sacrifice to be it, in order to be it. So he's described self-transcendence, and then he goes on to describe being in love, which we looked at before, as an experience of the fulfillment of that self-transcendence. Not permanently, but you might say a glimpsed, being in love is a glimpsed fulfillment of self-transcendence when it's attended to and embraced. Now, he admits the frequency in which love, loyalty, and faith are... love, loyalty, and faith are unauthentic sometimes. So the project of self-transcendence is lifelong. It's not something permanently achieved on a particular occasion. This is outside of question, more theologically specific questions of justification. Here he's talking about self-transcendence, and it's a lifelong project. In section 2 of the lecture, Lonergan turns to the topic of objectivity. So now we're getting closer to the topic of this lecture, religious knowledge. And he acknowledges that today we tend to regard inner conviction as private, as a matter of taste. That is the way inner conviction has come to be characterized, and you can trace that back to Hume and other philosophers, the fact-value distinction. But here he's just saying this phrase, inner conviction, has taken on that sense in the public, unfortunately. Additionally, the phrase objective truth has taken on the sense of public and spatial, out there for everybody to see. When you hear the phrase seeing is believing, or actually that's even slightly mistaken, seeing is knowing, that's a fairly widespread common sense understanding of how you reach the real. Remember, objectivity has to do with epistemic success. So it's your success in knowing. The misconstrual is objectivity in the sense of objects. That's so widely promoted in the present day, at least European, North American culture, that to be objective is to point at a material object that everybody can see. In a way, this is inherited by, as Lonergan says, the Royal Society and its scientific constraints. But we're going to see Lonergan very quickly goes to say, well, look, there's more to life than that. Man also lives in a world mediated by meaning. And this world includes all that is to be known by asking questions and arriving at correct answers. So not by pointing and looking, but by asking questions and arriving at answers. Now, I'm going to skip over section three, where he treats Aristotle and Newton, because I think we got a sense of that from the Larkin Stewart lectures that we read January 5th. If anyone sees something there that's crucial, maybe it can be brought up in the questions. But I'm going to skip that section, because I think section four, in a way, kind of gives you what you need to get out of the article. Three is pretty particular. So let's move to four. And in section four, Lonergan shows that among the Aristotelian notions that quietly survived right into Newton, namely via his necessary determinist mechanistic laws of nature, one of the Aristotelian things that survived was that science consisted in true and certain knowledge of causal necessity. This is why probability was at that time considered to be a cloak for ignorance. It's interesting how things can shift. With Heisenberg, the tables are turned, Lonergan says, and classical laws are now, in a sense, ignorant, because they require that the conditions stay the same for the laws to be fulfilled. If anything alien was introduced, the experiments don't work anymore. So the tables have really been turned in terms of what's considered ignorant. We see Darwin, quite novelly, took a statistical view of emergence, distribution, survival of plant and animal forms, and therefore, man's knowledge of them must evolve in order to correspond with the schedule of probabilities. This language is technical, and I don't think the main point that you would need to get here is that all of this, Heisenberg and Darwin and others, it demands a shift from logic to method. What does that mean? Well, it means removing logic from the central place it had for Aristotle. For Aristotle, the demonstrative syllogism is the key to arriving at the real. The problem is it forgets probability, schedules of probabilities, the importance of hypotheses, testing them, and it really conflicts with modern science, which is, as we heard in previous lectures here, the best opinion of the day. So this is a massive movement, at least in the sphere of science. And you might be wondering, well, why is he talking about Darwin and plant and animal forms when the topic of the lecture is religious knowledge? But he'll get to it. So the shift from logic to method removes logic from its central place, but it still keeps it as a tool for clarity and coherence. So it's not throwing logic out the door. It's simply turning considerations to method and then using logic as a tool to help the subject sort of navigate. Okay, section five. Lonergan asks, if science doesn't give us objective truth, here objective truth is that in that common sense, almost classical notion of looking, pointing, that's reality. If it doesn't do that, he says, where do we go? And I kind of like that, because it's such a frank question. Where do we go? Well, Lonergan proposes something called generalized empirical method. Now, it sounds frightening. And in a way, for those who have read the first chapter of Method and Theology, you know that transcendental method, which is very closely related, in fact, to be completely honest, I'm not entirely sure how GEM and transcendental
method. It's just a different word for the same thing.
So it's a new tag, and it's probably one that would be more easily accepted maybe by certain groups, self-transcendence might be regarded as warm and fuzzy. And this frightening phrase, you know, hey, he's got to be on to something, right? So, generalized empirical method, if you've read chapter one of Method of Theology, it's a transcendental method. What is that? It's a method that regards recurrent operations and it yields ongoing and cumulative results. So, whereas the natural sciences confine themselves to the data of sense, generalized empirical method also considers the data of consciousness. That's a first key distinction. Generalized empirical method, of course, is going to seek the features of all genuine methods and articulate those. So what he's looking for here is really an enveloping method that can be agreed upon by the religious studies people, by the theologians, by chemists, any given discipline. But he's saying you've got to consider the data of consciousness if you're going to use his method. Now, he does say that while he's seeking the common core of operations resident in experimental method of science and in the procedures of hermeneutics and historical study, while he does seek the common core, he does admit that the key event in the experimental method of science is discovery, whereas the key event in hermeneutics and history is understanding. So the disciplines are going to retain some discrete features. I mean, GEM doesn't wipe out what is particular to disciplines. It simply demands an enveloping set of just questions that be asked. And he fleshes this out, what the kind of exigence of this GEM is. On page 142, in an initial way, and then he gives it an entire page-long paragraph on 143. Now, I think instead of reading from there, if you'll forgive me, I'd like to once again turn to this my handout. And this time, look at the entry on method, again from this glossary project from the Lonergan website. Let me just read, if I might. This is from the entry on method, so this is just an excerpt. It says, generalized empirical method grants no exception for moral principles proposed by religions. I guess this is skipping ahead somewhat, but maybe just bear with me for the moment. So it doesn't grants no exception to the moral principles proposed by religions. So there's a tradition out there. It proposes symbols. It also proposes moral principles. GEM is saying, well, hang on. It also says a religious revelation is neither a delivery from the sky of inscribed tablets nor a dictation heard from unseen divinities. You can see where this is turning. It's turning to the subject. That's what generalized empirical method is going to see as central. In its data of consciousness sense, GEM, considers revelation as a judgment of value regarding known proposals, whether inscribed or spoken or imagined. Its religious sanction is based on a claim that the judgment is prompted by a transcendent love from a transcendent source in human hearts. That gives you a preliminary sense of what he's going to say about religious knowledge. It's certainly going to emerge from subjects being subjects, and that's what he named authenticity in the previous lecture. And generalized empirical method is just calling on subjects to be loyal to the norms of consciousness in whatever their discipline is. So if they're a chemist, they should be loyal to these norms. if they're religious studies or a theologian. And this is what Lonergan says in his conclusion, that inner conviction is not a matter of taste, as it has that sense, unfortunately, today. Rather, it's the fruit of self-transcendence, of being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. That's what inner conviction is. Now, he also recasts, then, objectivity. What does objectivity mean, given what he said? Well, in a world of immediacy, objectivity is bound up with the already out there, now real. That's a phrase from Insight that you may or may not be familiar with. And really all that means is the pointing that he talked about in the beginning. Objectivity, unfortunately, has come to be conceived of as looking and pointing for everyone to see. That's in the world of immediacy. Remember, he said, when you wake up, you go out into the world, you move into a world mediated by meaning. There's more to the story. So objectivity conceived in that world, that more ample world, is nothing more than the fruit of authentic subjectivity. Again, you've heard it many times, but you can never hear it enough. Being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. Thus, inner conviction, he says, is the conviction that the norms of those four things have been satisfied. Now, that's an incredibly massive move forward. And there's context behind this. I mean, it's taking Kant seriously and intentionality analysis from Husserl. But all we want to get from this article is the sense that objectivity in any domain, including within the domain of religion, is going to be nothing more than loyalty to those norms, those four norms. And that's why, in that excerpt we read, it said, you know, moral norms are not going to be deliveries from the sky or tablets. I mean, those may be worth appropriating, but those aren't sort of out there real. They have to be taken in, just as tradition was in the previous lecture, and appropriated. And how do you appropriate anything? Well, you submit it to the norms of what you are as a subject. So that's what will constitute religious knowledge, and it's an incredibly novel and slightly frightening proposal, but it is in keeping with this cognitional theory. So,
Thank you. This is, it's a radical conclusion, but it's part of what I meant at the beginning of, very beginning of the course, that he became more radical. Even after method and theology, but that final paragraph is if you wanted a paragraph that was what Lonergan is all about, it's the final paragraph of page 184. Inner conviction is the conviction that these norms have been satisfied, and satisfying those norms is the high road to objectivity. Okay, that was very well done, Jeff.
Thank you.
Anything that anybody wishes to raise or appropriate? I have a joke that I want to bring in, but I don't want to bring that in before.
I just have a quick thought here. Just this, in the definition of religion, where it says theology endeavors to discern whether there is any real fire behind the smoke of symbols. Employed in this or that religion, it would seem to me that if there wasn't any real fire, the symbol would cease to be meaningful.
Well, or the fire might be coming from somewhere else.
Okay. You know, in the inauthenticity.
Yep.
Okay.
You know, so it's to discriminate sort of where the fire is coming from. On the generalized empirical method and transcendental method question, this is just, I think this is it's a broad exegetical statement on my part, but generalized empirical method appears a couple of times in Insight as a phrase. And then, in order to, he thought it would be advantageous to switch the terminology to transcendental method, which is the terminology that he used for the same thing and method in theology. But as a matter of fact, he found it not advantageous, and he found that people were misinterpreting him as a Kantian because of the expression transcendental method, and that they weren't making the distinctions between his own work and that of people for whom he had a tremendous respect, like Joseph Maréchal and Karl Rahner, but from whom he differed on certain things, and he wanted to make it clear that. So, for instance, in a footnote, in even in Method and Theology, where he's continuing to use transcendental method as his category, there was a book by Otto Muck called The Transcendental Method, and Muck put all of these people together. And Lonergan said, I don't find the book all that helpful for saying what I'm all about. Because, I mean, he does, I mean, for all of his respect for Rahner and all of his, the fact that I emphasize very frequently with people, Lonergan people who want to criticize Rahner without appropriating him first, is that Lonergan never refers to Rahner except positively. And I think we need to pay attention to that. But he does say in a lecture that has not yet been published that the insight giving rise to concept is not in Maréchal, it's not in Rahner, and it is the key to the psychological analogy for the Trinity, for the procession, our understanding of the procession of the Word is the Word proceeds from understanding, at least in one of the analogies. So, which is why Rahner is perhaps weak on the Trinity, which a number of people have said. He doesn't get intelligible emanation of the Word from understanding. So, but then he went back to generalized empirical method because the use of the term transcendental method was confusing people, and that people, some people would hear it and say, "See, I told you, he's a Kantian," and other people would just not see that there were some differences between himself and other so-called transcendental Thomists. So he wanted to distinguish himself from that. The joke is that. I just thought of it when you said, Jeff, you know, you might be wondering why these animal forms appear in a book on, in a lecture on religious studies and theology. If you want to laugh, pick up this book called The Finer Points of Sausage Dogs. And it's a caricature of the Academy. There's a professor, there's a Professor von Trippendorf or something like that, in Germany, who is the world's leading expert on irregular Portuguese verbs. And he's written a book which is recognized by everybody as the book on it. And there's a Professor von Trupendorf, so almost the same word, who is a world's leading expert on dachshunds, sausage dogs. Well, a university in the United States, thinking that it's inviting Professor von Trupendorf to give a lecture, invites Professor von Trupendorf to give a lecture. So this world's expert on Portuguese, irregular Portuguese verbs, travels to the United States and gets there and finds out that he's expected to give a lecture on sausage dogs. And it is really fun. It's just a riot. So anyway, you can look that up. Okay, that's great. So next week is reading week. So and we'll finish these three lectures. I'll take the final one, the ongoing genesis of methods, which will still be on the relationship of religious studies and theology next week. And then we're going to slow down a little bit, but that's, I sort of put the schedule together this way, realizing that we probably would, and that's why I left the final class open. The human good and natural right and historical mindedness are both scheduled for March 2nd. I doubt that we're going to get into natural right and historical mindedness, and we're certainly not going to get through it, because it is one of the major papers in Lonergan's whole career. It's another one that if you wanted to give somebody, they would have to already be ready for this. It's not like introducing them through self-transcendence, for instance, a lecture self-transcendence, which is a very good piece to introduce people to Lonergan. Natural right and historical mindedness is more sophisticated, but it's a major, major piece of work. But I think what probably is going to happen for March 2nd is that we'll get through the ongoing genesis of method and the human good. You might want to read ahead to the natural right and historical mindedness just in case. Because the human good, I don't know how much I'm even going to emphasize it because it's the same as what he says in Method and Theology, so you probably are already familiar with it. So maybe we will get into natural right in this sort of things. Anyway, that's basically, we'll devote a good deal of time to the ongoing genesis of methods, which is an important piece. Okay, that's all that I need to. We have more time. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Very helpful and very well done. Excellent.
Thank you for allowing me to join you today.
Thank you. You're most welcome. Glad you were able to be here.